Okay. Right. Okay. So, not a formal meditation, but just to sometimes, if you've got several sessions a day, just to refocus the mind. So just get yourself into a good position. And the mind, just reflective, just reflective. Really, you're letting go of what happened at lunchtime, who you spoke to, what you ate, anything external, right up until now, just letting all of that go from the out-breath, just let it go. Releasing and relaxing on the out-breath. Just allowing your whole body to settle down on the out-breath. Maintaining that settled feeling, focusing now on the in-breath, and simply allowing your mind to brighten with each in-breath. Bring to mind the motivation that you had this morning. Bring it to the front of your mind and just gently and mentally gaze at that. And thinking about shamatha and its relationship to vipassana. Just consider this illustration that Lam Alan Wallace gives. See if you can relate to this. Imagine that you're walking into a dark room. And on one wall, there is a huge, beautiful, famous tapestry. But the light in the room is quite dim. And there's a window open, and there's some flickering of the dim light. Our observation of this tapestry is very impaired. Now imagine that that room is now fully illuminated with radiant, steady light. Now examine the tapestry. How vivid. How expansive the images. And consider that likewise, when the analysis, when you're analyzing the nature of phenomena with Vipassana, if it's supplemented by penetrating, intellectual, unwavering, sustained volitional attention. The true nature of phenomena will be clearly observed. because with that light, it has dispelled the five obscurations temporarily, but they're dispelled. The Buddha in the sutras says this. Without the quelling of these five hindrances, one considers himself as if in debt, as if in bonds, as if enslaved, as if lost on a desert track. And it's not possible to know one's own welfare, another's welfare, or the welfare of both. Simply consider that. Thank you. So again, no need to write all this down, but if you want, but it's all in Alan's book, Lama Alan's book, page 164, when you have time. Very nice to reflect on that. So gathering our thoughts, we see quite clearly that once the four stages have been achieved, then it's possible to choose which object you wish to develop your attentional skills further. You will still need whatever object you choose, even if it's a visualized object, which it could be, you still need that relaxation, that stability, that vividness. So practice the socks off that. Practice the socks of that. Make sure that in your practice that's supported by even more relaxation. And when you say to yourself, I can't relax anymore, relax more. You can. Watch for stillness. Stillness is important. When you get to this stage, movement of the body and the mind are so closely linked. If it's possible, you don't want to be holding yourself like this and you don't want to get tense about it. But with stability, if you can just enhance that, by just being still, not making external movements, just let that go. And then being vigilant. This raising of the sternum is very helpful if you're sitting. And if you're in the supine, just reminding yourself it's a meditation posture. Now, when we looked at stages 3 and 4, this question of mindfulness came up, this question of mindfulness. Now, the mindfulness that the Buddha talked about, sati, is not the same as the popular mindfulness movement that we have in the world today. The popular movement we have on mindfulness courses, today is extremely helpful to people, so beneficial. It's helped hundreds and thousands of people. And their focus really is, you're looking at really at bare attention, non-judgmental, bare attention, being in the moment, very open presence. That is extremely helpful and very beneficial to people who have difficulties with this life, And that's clear. Where does the difficulty come? Well, if you're in Lama Alan's presence, he would then give you a 40-minute diatribe on the whole thing. I shall reduce it to a few minutes. The problem comes when people get that mixed up. The word mindfulness as being the same thing as mindfulness within the Dharma, what the Buddha meant. And it's not. It's not. And because people don't see the difference, the confusion can be very strong. I mean, I can't, there's been a few times when I've been in Preston and then once in Leeds when I was asked to teach a little bit on meditation and I include shamatha. And when I explained mindfulness, I had people in the class that said, that's wrong. That's wrong. That's just not right. And, you know, and I'm saying, well, what do you think it is? And they give me the modern Vipassana, being in the moment, non-judgmental, open approach. And it took a while on both occasions for the people to actually, not the people, I mean, there was only one person in Preston and two people in these, but to actually hear what I was saying, that mindfulness as practiced generally now is fantastic. It has a job to do. And that job was to make this life more bearable for people who are overwhelmed with suffering. Is it beneficial? Absolutely. Should it be practiced? Definitely. Is it what the Buddha talked about? No. And even when John Kabat-Zinn was, Lama Alan was talking about that, even when he went to His Holiness with this idea of promoting mindfulness, His Holiness said it was a wonderful idea, absolutely fantastic, yet very helpful. It's not Dharma, but very helpful. So here, when we're looking at shamatha, we need to be clear that when we're talking about mindfulness, we're talking about a faculty here, which is crucial. It is a faculty, a mental faculty of mindfulness, is that ability to attend continuously to a chosen object without forgetfulness, without distraction, without losing or forgetting the object. That's sati. That's the mindfulness we're looking here. We're not saying it's better. We're saying if you're working with shamatha, this is mindfulness. If you're working with mindfulness in relation to helping people live a better life, these general man, then that's also very good. They won't learn shamatha because it's not the right type of mindfulness, but very useful. But here, the faculty of mindfulness, attending continuously to a chosen object without forgetfulness, without distraction, not forgetting the object, not losing the object. That's mindfulness. And that's the mindfulness that you need in stages 3 and 4. That's what you need. If you want to go further than this, then certainly Lama Alan's got lots of teachings on this and quoting many Tibetan scholars. The ones he emphasizes is Asanga, of course. When Asanga talks about about mindfulness, he says mindfulness is non-forgetfulness of the mind with respect to a familiar object. It has the function of non-distraction. This is a typical Asanga. Asanga gives the nature of something, and then it gives its function. It's a very, very clear Asanga on these things. So non-forgetfulness of the mind with respect to a familiar object with the function of non-distraction. This is all in Alan's book, don't worry. Vasubandhu, another scholar that we go back to time and time again, very simple. He said mindfulness is not losing the object presented to the mind. Now, when you read modern psychology now, mindfulness is, you know, they're trying to get in on the whole thing now. You know, they like all mindfulness, you know. 15 years ago, wouldn't even look at it, but now they're looking at it. But most psychology now, when they give definitions of mindfulness, they take those definitions from the modern Vipassana movement. That's where they take their definitions from. So be clear in your own mind. If you look up sati from the Pali, mindfulness, there's another connotation of awareness, which is derived from a root, which means to remember. In the Pali, it's got a characteristic of not floating away from the object. Not floating away. And Buddha Ghosa, who is the go-to scholar, one of the most respected from Mahayana, Theravada, most respected scholar, people always go back to him. And he says mindfulness has the characteristics of remembering. Its function, not to forget. Well, you know where he's coming from. It manifests as guarding. Guarding, that's how it manifests, as guarding. Another term we're going to be introduced to now is introspection. Introspection, work hand in hand with mindfulness. Introspection has a characteristic of being non-confusing. Non-confusion. It has a function, and that function is to investigate. Investigate. How does it manifest? Buddha Ghosa says it manifests as scrutiny. So whenever you get to this stage and you're looking at mindfulness, introspection comes right in. You're talking about non-confusion. You're talking about a function of investigating. It manifests as being as scrutinizing. Sangha says, mindfulness prevents the mind from straying away from the meditative object. Introspection recognizes that attention has strayed from the object. I kind of like that. It's kind of short and to the point. Shantideva says the same thing, but he goes further. He says introspection is repeated examination of the state of the body and mind. Repeated examination of the state of the body and mind. Now, when we think about repeated examination, it sounds very heavy. In fact, it feels as if you have to forget everything. It's not like that. It's not like this. By the time you get to stage four, introspection will come very, very... Actually, it kicks in earlier than that. It starts to... In Kamala Shila, it sort of says it comes in at probably stage five. But there must be some form of introspection when you notice in stage three that your mind's not on the object. I don't know how strong it is, but I think my feeling is maybe a little bit there, maybe a little bit there. It comes into its own in stage five because you've got strong mindfulness. It's mindfulness is the problem. It's mindfulness that you have most of your energy devoted to, but I'm convinced there's a bit of introspection going on here, but introspection definitely comes in at stage five. And so there's a popular drawing of shamatha. I don't know, you can probably get it on the net. And it's kind of got, well, to be honest, it never helps me. But basically, it's talking about, it's illustrating taming the wild elephant mind, really. And to tame the wild elephant mind, two things are needed. And on that drawing, there's a lasso. And that lasso is the tether of mindfulness. In the other hand, there's a picture of like a rod, and that's the goad of introspection. There's some good teachings on the web. I just never found it personally helpful, but many people do. The lasso of mindfulness and the goad of introspection. That's what that particular one is reasonably getting you to think about. So let's see what that means. For the stages. So if you look at your stages of the path again, so if we look at stage four, again, we could see, I know we've done this, but that's close attention. Your mind is no longer forgetting the object. It's kind of, you know, the bandwidth is pretty strong, and sometimes there's a lot of noise, and sometimes your chosen object is just on the periphery, but still, you're not forgetting the object at any time during your session. And as I say, many people ask, well, how long should I be meditating? And they don't really say. I push Lama Allen a bit, And he said, well, if you're not doing it for about an hour, at least. So that's about as definite as he was, to me anyway. Okay. By the time stage four comes, you're now an experienced shamatha trainee. Before that, he likes you to refer to yourself as developing shamatha. If someone says, what do you do? I'm developing shamatha. That's what he likes people to think. By the time you've achieved stage four, you're now an experienced shamatha trainee. So if we look at stage five, what you're looking at is tamed attention. And I think that that's very helpful. That's very helpful. You've already got mindfulness, which is quite strong. So what's the power for achieving tamed attention? The power here is introspection. It is introspection. And once you have that, you're at the stage where your laxity and your dullness is at the medium level. It's a huge achievement. Gone, of course, before was gross or coarse agitation. But at this stage, gone is coarse dullness. You're left now with the traffic of coarse, of medium agitation and medium dullness. It is said that stages five and six, these two, there's such a sense of achievement at this stage, such a sense of achievement, that you could actually be mistaken for thinking you've reached shamatha. That's what the texts say. You have to be kind of careful at this stage, because the sense you have, they say, is of such achievement that you think you're there. Looking at stage six, is passive attention. At this stage, you have no resistance now in training your attention. There is no resistance. You are in the zone here. No resistance. The power of introspection is now extremely strong. And it's tethered closely to mindfulness, but it's very, very strong in introspection. You know the difference, because although you have medium laxity, you have subtle, only subtle excitation left. Only subtle. The power for five and six is through introspection. So once more, Padmasambhava does encourage the use of multiple methods. If you are actually coming up with kind of tenacious obstacles, he's very clear. He said, if you stay with one object, that's very good, but there's such benefits in changing, making the, when your mind is strong enough, when your mindfulness is strong, choosing a subtler object can have a lot of benefit. He said, especially if you're the type of person that's prone to a lot of excitement. I don't mean excitation, restlessness. If you're a type that really gets conceptual turbulence, then if you've achieved that level of mindfulness, then choosing a subtler object would be very beneficial. One of the biggest benefits of changing to a subtler object of mind and its contents as aware or awareness is because you begin to really know your mind. You're beginning to get a deeper insight to the nature of mind. And that's value that can't be calculated. In our ordinary everyday life, most people, us included, well, what is the mind? Oh, I'm not sure. Oh, don't, I need a lot of training on the mind. Well, just sit with your mind. Yeah, but I don't know if I'm with my mind. You know, it's all this, you know. Whereas once you've got the concentration by the end of stage four, if you do change your talk, if you decide to change to a subtler, then the subtler would be mind and its contents, mind and mental events, or awareness. And the greatest benefit is that deep insight into the nature of the mind. When you're resting your mind, whether you're resting your mind in observing the mental contents, whether you're resting in pure awareness, anything, all objects that normally disturb your mind will tend to go right down. There is an easy, becomes easier to, what Lama Allen calls settle, and also Padmasambhava, settling the mind in its natural state. Going deeper, getting the snorkel on, getting the oxygen tanks on and going deeper. And when you go deeper, settling the mind in its natural state being bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. Now again, this is not the ultimate nature of mind. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the substrate. I'm talking about, you know, like a subtle level of mind. What is its qualities? Bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality. And when you start doing this type of meditation, and again, I'm not talking about once a day. I'm talking about when you decide to go into retreat and really start to develop it. You're coming down from this skiing and skipping on the water. You've got your snorkel on. You've got your tank on. You're so close to the nature of the mind that once you're into meditation, what happens is the true nature qualities sometimes pass up and you get a taste of it. And people often report a taste of bliss. And when you ask them to describe it, they go... And all they can do is say, well, it's better than sex. It's just, and then they stop. There's no real words, but you get a taste. For some people, depending on their propensities, what they tend to get occasional tastes of is luminosity. And again, when you say to them, what is it like? They go, we think of luminosity as being a bright light, but it's not like that. It seems to be more to do with illuminating the nature of the mind, making visible what's there. Do you know what I mean? It's luminous. And then for other people, you know, what comes up for a taste, and this is with a lot of practice, is non-conceptuality. And unless you're doing this practice, you don't know what's going on because you're awake. You're bright, you're in the zone, and nothing is going on. There are no thoughts. There are not. You're just sitting there going, you know, you're just there. And it's bright. But there's no concepts. There's no concepts. And there's never been a time, really, when we've had no concepts. What makes us human, I wonder? Certainly concepts, but nothing there. So, I'm not saying this will happen to everybody, but it is reported regularly. This is not somebody giving you something. It's not the Buddha coming going, now you will have bliss. No way. It's coming from your mind. It's coming from the nature of your mind. To gain access to that, to get closer to reality, then you're getting closer to these qualities. And these are qualities of the nature of the mind. Bliss. Jenny?
Can you say how this relates to Mahamudra? Because it seems that there are some...
There are differences. I'll try to do that towards...
Maybe later on.
Well, towards the end, because I don't want to bring in too many contrasting... I mean, you're right, but the language is different in Mahamudra. It is completely different. And I think towards the end, I'll say, I mean, I'm not a great scholar, as you know, but there are differences, and I'll bring that into, what, if you don't mind, towards the end. But for the moment, this is what you, it doesn't change. I mean, what you feel, the things that arise, is no different in Mahamudra. No different. Mahamudra, but it's the cause is different, the labeling is different, and the idea of Buddha nature is different. So, but we'll definitely, I'll do my best.
It's sounding like the experience is similar, but obviously the goal and what one is wanting to do, the purpose is quite different.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, according to Lama Alan, because I asked him completely, I said, don't get me confused with this.
Okay.
But as is well in the future, I kind of think I'll when I'm closer. But I'll definitely, we'll see what I can do closer to the end of that.
Okay. Thanks.
The thing to remember about all of this, it's all coming from your own mind, right? At the moment, how is bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality, how is that expressed? It's when I say it's there, it is there, but the energy is always flowing upwards. It's always flowing upwards. And there are expressions of this, and here's the problem. The expressions are mixed with our perception of reality, our erroneous perception of reality, our misknowing of reality. So if you take anger, for instance, anger is not a lump of stuff that is hanging about in your mind. And if you could just find it and be a nice person, you can get rid of it. Really, that's how I used to think, right? It's not like that. It's the more you meditate, the more you understand the nature of reality, then this misknowing of reality becomes lighter and lighter and lighter. And then you find the stem cell of that energy. And that stem cell of the energy is bliss. That's bliss. It's not coming from anywhere else. But because we misknow reality, and then we don't just misknow it and think, oh, I think I've just misknown. You've no choice. You just do. And then you act on it. You just act on it. And that just distorts this primal energy of bliss. Because we misknow reality, we have a very strong idea. We don't just misknow reality, but we misknow just looking at how, you know, karma, that's quite big. But misknowing all of this, then that leads, you have no choice. That leads immediately to I, me, and mine. And as long as we've got I, me, and mine, you're over there and you remain over there. And I, me, and mine is what's important. Because this is mine, it's not yours. And then you've no choice. That then goes on. I want that. I want that. I don't want that. And I don't want. So attachment and aversion just rides in on the wave. You've no choice. Rides in the wave. And with attachment and aversion, what is that doing to your mind, this coarse mind that we deal with? It makes us behave with our body, speech, and mind in so many negative ways. We just muddy the water even more. And when we behave in these ways, because of our misknowing of reality, because of attachment and aversion, what we do with our body, speech, and mind tends to be, on the whole, quite negative. And if it stopped there, we'd be okay, but it doesn't. It plants karmic seeds on the mind stream. And then when, you know, the right causes and conditions arise, they ripen and the whole thing starts again. It doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. Now imagine if there was no ignorance, if there was no misunderstanding of the nature of reality, there'd be no I, me, and mine, which makes you very different. You are different from me. I'm not saying you're not. But there's no grasping to this because this doesn't exist. This I doesn't exist. There's no aversion. There's no grasping and aversion. What do you think your mind's going to be like? How do you think you're going to behave with your body, speech, and mind? Quite differently. And then what's going to happen with karma? Doesn't matter. You don't create positive karma, you create no karma. So when I say to you, anger at its root is bliss, that's its stem cell. Can you see? We distort that bliss by how we behave, how we view the world, how we view ourselves and others, and how we act from that ignorance. That's muddying that water. You can't see it. I mean, when I was teaching in school, when I was in Leeds, my friend Wendy, she said, you know, if you're talking about the mind to the children, taking a glass and have something in the bottom, I'm trying to remember completely, but something in the bottom, put a lot of dirt in the water, stir it around, and then ask them to watch. And say to them things like, this is how our mind is if we're not quiet and still and things like this. And then I put one of these shiny beads at the bottom. When it's settled, I said, now the first person to tell me if they see something special there. And then eventually they could see it. It was always there. It was always there. Now, I'm very grateful for my friend for telling me, you know, to use these demonstrations, because I think I learned more than the children, really. So now we look at craving. Is craving a lump? A huge mental attitude that if we just decide to get rid of it and be a nice person, it'll go away? No. Go down and down and down and down and down. What do you find? What is the stem cell of all of this? Luminosity. Luminosity. And the same rationale applies. Delusions. Delusions. Again, not a lump waiting to be dealt with. Deal with ignorance, attachment, and aversion. Clear the water. Let the water settle. See what's really there. And if you go down with delusion, what you find is non-conceptuality. So maybe something to think about. I bring it in here simply to say there are benefits from going to a subtler object. However, if you are happy with your original object and you think you can take, then use it. It's not bad. It's just you have a choice. And the mind that's making the choice now on an object is not the same mind at end of stage four. Do you understand? At that time, just make a choice. Just make a choice. You have choices. Okay. Oh dear. Right, all right. Any ideas, comments, thoughts? No. Okay. Now, when the Buddha said, you're like someone who's in debt, who's in bondage, who's extremely ill, and who's lost in a desert track. What he's saying is, this is the mind of someone who still has the five obscurations, the five obscurations. Now, we've looked at applying various remedies to difficulties that come up in the mind. Okay? But these five difficulties, these five obscurations, are the thing that's preventing us from achieving shamatha, from seeing things as they are. Now, the first one is lethargy and drowsiness. Well, no problem there. We've been talking about this all the way. Lethargy and drowsiness. If I could put it into words in my own mind, it's more the case of, oh Lord, this is too difficult. I'm a bit tired. Could they not make it simpler? When I hear myself thinking like that, that to me, that's the start of lethargy and drowsiness. Yeah. So tricky. The second obscuration. In some texts, they call it uncertainty. In most recent comments, they call it afflictive uncertainty. It's okay to be uncertain about things that it's good to be uncertain about. But if you're presented with something that is kind of real, true, and actual, what you don't want is afflictive uncertainty. So afflictive uncertainty, that's... You can see yourself, can't you? You've had really good teachings, you've got the text, you're doing the practice, and you're halfway through something and you suddenly stop and you think, am I wasting my time? Maybe I should be visualizing. Maybe that's what I should be doing. Or maybe this other teacher, I hear he's got, you know, I don't know about this anymore. Maybe it's that kind of, I'm not sure, am I wasting my time? That's how it feels to me, afflictive uncertainty. The third obscuration is called sensual craving. So this is craving for any of the objects of the five senses. It's not saying you shouldn't have these objects. Of course, no problem. It's craving for it. And craving is more than desire. It's more than desire, this craving. Just give me, you know, the craving. I want it, it's mine. Craving. And that craving could be anything you see, anything you hear, anything you taste, anything you touch, anything you smell. If you have craving from any of these five senses, it's an obscuration. Now think why. The realm that we're in now is called the desire realm. And what is it we desire? We desire objects of the five senses. Thank you very much. Get them lined up now. That's what we want. But what's your journey going towards? Your journey is going towards access of the form realm. It's going, now all nine stages are in the desire realm, that's true. But your aim is towards the 10th level where you have access to the formless realm. The form realm. So you have to start dealing with these craving for objects of the five senses now. That's really important. The fourth one, it's interesting. The fourth one is malice. Malice. And when you think about malice, you may think, I don't have malice. I don't have malice. How do you think malice expresses itself? Can I ask that? Can anybody tell me how malice would express itself? How would you know if you had malice in your mind now? How would you know? How would it express itself?
Protection.
Protection?
Not openness.
Okay, certainly with malice, you are guarding who you are and what you think you are, for sure. But we're doing that all the time. So maybe an exaggeration of that, I think that would be part of it. Anything else?
Probably a level of grumpiness and irritation.
I think that would be part. Seems reasonable. Yes, Stella.
Negative thoughts about another person.
I think that escalates to that. Yes. Yes. That sounds good. What else? Hi, Miguel.
Good to see you, Venerable Mary.
Lovely to see you, dear.
Yeah, a long time.
Too long.
You know, that it has its roots in anger and resentment often. Mm-hmm. So wishing bad things were happening to other people or seeing them in a not beneficial light, wishing them
now
bad.
Now we're escalating. Now it's not just one, it's the escalation that you've got to catch.
And from there you can actually go to a place where you wish them harm.
Yes.
Your anger overtakes you.
Yes. Malice, That's exactly how simple. All you've said is like an increase. It's like the stages of reaching up to really wanting to harm. And the mind of malice is so close to the mind of activating that malice. It's one of the most destructive things you can do. One of the most destructive things you can do. And the thing about malice is it can be hidden. People keep it secret. It's quite hard to hide anger. People can usually pick out if you've got ill will, although that's part of it, against someone. It'll come out eventually. But malice, there's something secretive about that. And sometimes you don't even tell yourself it's there, malice. And so this is one of the five obscurations. And the last one, of course, excitation and anxiety. That's the last one. Excitation and anxiety, of course. So this lethargy and excitation, we've discussed in depth. Sensual craving, it makes sense on the path you're on. This is a mind, with sensual craving, this is the mind that sees all happiness is coming from outside in. This is true. If I can just see this person, if I can just hear this music, if I can just hear this, it's everything feeding the senses, bringing me happiness. And not getting that brings me unhappiness. So basically, happiness and unhappiness comes from outside. If you've got a mind like that, what are you diving into? What are you putting your snorkeling on and diving deep into? If you need to get this. So now the interesting thing is, can you deal with these levels now? Yes. See the growth of it. See the growth of it. This doesn't start from nowhere. The little bit of fruition of all of these things, notice it. It all comes from ignorance, but sometimes it's hard to go back to that. So notice its growth. Stop it as early as you can, before it becomes fully flourished and your mind is totally overwhelmed. Now, what can help them? Well, the Buddha said that with lethargy and drowsiness, how you overcome that. And Padmasambhava, again, I haven't read original teachings, only from what Lama Alan has directed me to and I've read. The main thing, if you notice that, is coarse examination. Coarse examination. Literally pull out all the stop. This is not subtle. I'll just let my mind laze on this and get. No. I have lethargy and drowsiness. What's causing this? Coarse examination. Lethargy and drowsiness does not flourish when you look at it that closely. Coarse examination. That's your direct antidote to this. When you notice afflictive uncertainty, notice it occurring from its earliest stages, really, from its earliest stages. The thing with meditation teaches you to recognize what's going on the mind earlier and earlier and earlier. Normally, we don't notice we're angry until we're absolutely angry. And you say, how did that happen? I don't know. It was just that. No. No. You can catch that earlier and earlier and earlier if you meditate, until some people, they can actually just notice a slight change in their attention. And they know that's going to give rise, and they deal with it here, just as it begins to arise. Just as it begins to arise. So, afflictive uncertainty. Having confidence in the practice is important. If you are fortunate to have faith, strong faith in the Dharma, in the Buddha, in the Sangha, you have strong faith, and afflictive uncertainty, tricky. It's there, but it usually only arises when you when you're failing to get what you think you should get, really. How do we deal with afflictive uncertainty? Well, according to the text, precise investigation. With afflictive uncertainty, look at it closely. What is it you're uncertain about? Well, I just don't think it's, if you ask someone, you know, I'm just not sure. You know, they find it difficult to put into words. So they're going on their emotion. With afflictive uncertainty, be precise. Really look at it. Be forensic. And forensic and precise investigation should weaken afflictive uncertainty. With the obscuration of sensual craving, it is said that what helps that is single-pointed attention. Single-pointed attention. I'm never pretty sure, with single-pointed attention, if you're developing shamatha single-pointedly, will that help? Well, yeah, but it's still there, isn't it? What I find is if there's anything I'm particularly want and need in relation to the five senses, I kind of bring it up, this is up to yourself, I bring it up to my mind. I put it front and center. And then I single-pointedly gaze at that. And what I'm looking for is its nature. What is its nature? I don't interact with it. I look at it closely. Just gently, without interacting. What's its nature? And because it disappears and it continues to disappear under single-pointed attention in that way, it has no substance. And the next time it arises, when you're out and about, it kind of feels a bit ridiculous. It's like reducing it. Its importance being, I want to, how ridiculous that I want that. It's kind of like that. Sometimes. See what you come up with yourself. See what you come up with yourself. Malice. And malice from its very inception all the way through to full-blown malice. What they say in the text is, develop a sense of well-being. Malice comes from a mind that's very unhappy and really wants others to be that unhappy. This is not a well mind. This is a mind that hurts. It hurts for some reason. It's not a well mind. And so the antidote to that is to develop a sense of well-being, a sense of well-being. If you understand the Lam Rim, then really what you're looking at here is the preciousness of this life. How precious, this is what I use anyway, the preciousness of this precious human rebirth. Bodhicitta. But for me, I have a very prosaic mind, so the first level is good enough for me. Precious human rebirth, that gives me a sense of well-being, whatever's going on. And so well-being is the antidote to malice. Then this excitation and anxiety. Well, it says that the opposite of that, that how to deal with that is bliss. And I think because you're working through the nine stages, rooting out more and more subtle levels of excitation, which is this is about, and dullness, that when that goes, I think bliss arises. It seems to, so they say, you're so close to shamatha, but I'm not sure that you can generate bliss to do it. I don't know. Because the bliss that comes from shamatha is not like having a good time. That seems to be even more agitation for the mind. So on that one, I'm still kind of figuring that one out. Obviously, I'm figuring a lot of this out, but never mind. Now, the interesting thing about the five obscurations and the five remedies is, although you can start, if you know about it, you can start applying, recognizing earlier and applying. If you are on the road to shamatha, then these remedies are already within your mind. They're already there. And the closer you get to shamatha, and I'm talking about stage 8 and 9 now, these start to arise spontaneously. They arise spontaneously whether you're thinking about them or not thinking about them, whether you're activating or not activating, they're there. And they deal with the five obscurations completely. It is the best thing you can think about the mind healing itself. So although we apply these remedies and it's useful, what comes from the mind subdues them. Just they have no energy now. And it's the mind doing that to the mind. Now this subduing is temporary. It lasts for as long as your shamatha lasts. You know, they've not gone. They're temporarily. You've got a foothold into the, you've got slight access to the form realm, but they've not gone. But they're so quiet, they're passive. And so you can get on and do your job to penetrate reality. And then they will go completely. But at this stage, it's a temporary suspension of that. So just consider that for a moment, see if you have any questions in that area. Just think about that. Yes? Rowena?
Venerable Mary, so you can hear me?
Oh, yes, thank you.
Okay. So just under malice, would you say that resentments would come into that? Do you think, like, because resentments, for me anyway, your resentments usually grow and grow and grow.
There are, in the Dharma, in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, we don't have a god, but we do have lists. Loads and loads and loads of lists. And each one on these lists has loads and loads of definitions. And they will take several words that we lump together into kind of one idea, and they'll pull it apart and give each one a definition. So with malice, is there some resentment in there? Maybe. Sounds reasonable to me. But is it malice? No, I don't think it's malice. It's too temporary for malice. It's too fleeting. You can be resentful one moment and not resentful the next. Malice has got something else. It feels like it's all of this and it's dug in. And it doesn't matter what's presented to you, what is given is always through malice. You know, I never know people who've got temporary malice. Do you? I know people who've got temporary resentment. Temporary anger, definitely. Temporary malice? People tend to say that is a malice person. That's a malice. And it's all, there's a kind of longevity there. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's anything to beat yourself up with. It's just something to recognize. We don't use any of this to beat ourselves up with. God. I never quite got the hang of that. All this self-hatred business, never got that. My granny used to say, there's enough people out there, Mary, that'll put you down, don't do it to yourself. I thought that was very wise.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Anyone else? Yes, Ali.
If you came across someone who was suffering from malice, how could you best help them, or can you?
Don't know. It depends on the situation. I think malice is so deep. If you've got the skills. So let's say you're a trained counsellor and you've dealt with this type of thing before. Maybe it's your area of expertise. It would be helpful if you were a friend of this person or this person liked you, wouldn't it? Just because you think you see it in others, it doesn't mean say that you have to step in and do something about it. If you don't have the skills, then what do? You don't make it worse. Not for that person and not for you. So simply, as Shanti Davis said, if you don't have the skills and something is presented to you, be like a block of wood. Whatever's coming at you, let it just bounce off. Just be like a block of wood. There's a lot of people think they can help people. I've met a lot of people, a lot of counsellors. And when I ask what qualification, they say, no, it's just intuitive. I think that's nice. A lot of that around. It's not my idea. You step in if you think you can help. You don't step in to point out the problem. I don't see that as helpful at all. I think that just makes people even more angry. But if you have the skills and you think you can help, sure. Remember Shantideva? Shantideva said, it's almost impossible to help people unless you've got clairvoyance. That's what he said. That's why, his idea is get in and learn, get and develop shamatha now. If you really want to benefit all sentient beings, get some clairvoyance. And you think to yourself, people, well, it's really true, isn't it? If you ask someone what the problem is, what's the chances of them actually telling you? Not good. And even if they hit on it, do you think they're going to tell you exactly how they're feeling? Even when we try to help people, the chances of being, it's good, never stop trying to help, never stop giving. But if it works or not, don't worry. The real trick is to help as much as you can, but don't hang on to the result because you've no control. There's too many variables. We have to deal with the mote in our own eye before we can deal with others. At the moment, all of us sitting here, I am sure, would think we don't have malice. I'm sure we think that because we're reasonably nice people, eh? But it is there. You can't help it. You didn't choose this. This has come from lifetime to lifetime simply because of how we view reality. And from then onwards, you're on a hiding to remain in desire realms. Doesn't stop. You have to intervene some way. This will only stop. This continuous rebirth is only going to stop if you intervene. To skill yourself up, to intervene effectively, you learn shamatha. Then you're effective. This is what Shanti Deva really is saying, I think. I'm not putting words in his mouth, but it seems to me to be that. Thank you very much, Ali. And that comes from a mind that wants to help. Yes, everybody wants to help. And often when we try and do something, it can make the situation so much worse. So you, whatever skills you have, you do your best, you give, you the charity, there's different types of giving. So learn the four types of giving and give as much as you can, but don't hold on to the result. There's too many variables. Give and let go. Give, then no expectations of anything. That's the way forward. Otherwise, you'll get compassion fatigue, and we can't have that. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. So I think now we'll do a meditation on the next meditation on the four immeasurables. And I highly recommend Lama Alan's book on the four immeasurables. Very clear. Very clear. To be honest, there's a lot of good books on the four dimensions. There's a lot of good stuff on bodhicitta. However, I've found the most effective for meditation is Lama Alice. Very good. So please get yourself into a really nice position, comfortable. Just take a minute to check your posture. Give yourself the best chance of a really good meditation. Check your comfort, how you're sitting, where your hands are, how your head is held. Just get yourself into the right position. Relaxing on the out-breath. Brightening your awareness on the in-breath. And just begin to consider compassion. In Dharma, immeasurable compassion is not an emotion. It's an aspiration. It's a heartfelt yearning that all be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. It's asking, what can I do? Well, we can start with being very careful of being contemptuous of others. Be careful about taking any pleasure in someone else's suffering. Remedy any of that with empathetic joy. This will give us a start. Attend to the rhythm of your breath. Allow it to flow naturally. Be relaxed. Be still. Be clear. Reflecting on your life, ask yourself the question, how long have I struggled to be free of anxiety and dissatisfaction? How long? Do my tendencies of thinking and behaving in certain ways get in the way of developing compassion. With everything that's going on in the world, deeply ask yourself, how can I free myself of the inner causes of suffering, since I have so little control of outer circumstances? How can I free myself of the inner causes of suffering? Question yourself. Now the immeasurable aspiration, may I be free. May I be free of the true causes of my sadness, of my worry. Then imagine that you are free of this. Can I see the pointlessness of craving, hostility, and confusion? Can I see that? How pointless that is. Imagine that you are free of this, and you have serenity and the joy of a balanced mind that's in tune with reality. Imagine that you have that now. Focus. Bring to mind a loved one who is suffering now, physically, psychologically, someone who is in distress, someone you're close to. With love and compassion in your heart, fully immerse yourself. Be present with their causes of suffering. Be present with it. See how difficult it is for this person, how sad. Shift your perspective to yourself again. Looking at that individual, allow yearning to increase. May you be free from suffering and its causes. Mean it. May you be free. And as you think that, as you yearn for that, imagine that this person finds relief, finds the freedom that's needed to be happy and live a meaningful life. See it happening. Imagine another person who wants to be free of suffering, but due to delusion, causes more suffering for themselves and others. We all know people like that. Imagine this person. They want to be free of suffering, but they're so covered with delusion, they make themselves worse and they harm others. Now step into their perspective. Feel their fear. Feel their own suffering. Feel their difficulties. And once you get a taste of that, step back into your own perspective. You, unlike them, understand the consequences of these delusions and behavior. Make a strong wish. May they be free. Feel it strongly. May they be free. May they be drawn to some sort of clear vision of the nature of reality and a path that would lead them to see it. May this happen for this individual strongly. Imagine they're free now. Imagine how happy they would be. This happiness, there'll be no idea of harming others. Delusion's gone. Broaden your scope of awareness now across the world. So easy to do now. Attend to those who are suffering all over the world, physically, psychologically, sociologically. A compassionate heart knows that they all deserve compassion, all of them. They all act from delusion. They harm themselves, they harm others. Embrace the world with your immeasurable compassion. May we all be free of suffering and the true causes of suffering. May we all help each other. May we ease each other's pain. Develop the thought, may I develop the internal conditions so that I can develop immeasurable compassion for all sentient beings without exception. May I develop that internal condition. Make that as strong as you can in your mind. And when it's strong, let go of all mental chatter and focus on that aspiration. When the mind wanders, just recognize it's wandered, bring it back. May I develop this. Thank you. I very much like the meditations that Lam Alan puts in his books. It often asks you to change your perspective, often. And I find that really helpful, really helpful. It closes the gap between yourself and others. It seems to draw you kind of close. I mean, there is a difference, but it kind of closes that gap. And to understand that people who are harming, our normal mind says, bad then, do this. But to try to understand and really look at the root. And in a lot of his meditation, he does ask you to change that perspective. Yeah, I find it very useful. So, time to maybe talk amongst yourselves. So in pairs, that would be nice. What I'd like you to, I mean, focus on anything, but my advice would be to look at the five obscurations. If you have difficulty in what to say about the five obscurations, then maybe rate them for yourself. The five obscurations, which one would be the easiest for me to deal with? Which one would be the most difficult to deal with? That's if you've got a difficulty how to discuss that. I find that's quite a nice one. So the five obscurations, you remember? Lethargy and drowsiness is the one. The second one is uncertainty, afflictive uncertainty, sensual craving, malice, and excitation and anxiety. So discuss that. And if you have difficulty discussing, then see which one you would find easiest to deal with and which one you might find it more difficult. Just something like that. Just start the mind revolving around those topics. You have 15 minutes. Excellent. Welcome back. We're on the last leg of today. So deep breath. So from your discussion, the discussion is what's important, but if there's anything you want to feedback, then fair enough, you don't have to, but if you want to feedback, that's fine. Everyone's quiet. Well, that's okay. Okay, I hope you enjoyed the discussion. It's very good to get to know each other and see where you are. Okay. So I think I want to just say now that it seemed to me that on the retreat, there are some people who are treating it like a retreat and some people who are teaching it as, taking it as teachings. That's fair enough. And for those of you who are teaching it as a retreat, tomorrow morning is personal practice. If you're used to doing individual retreats, then you don't need my advice. Off you go. If, however, you're not that used to doing individual retreats, then you take tomorrow morning as personal practice. So really what you're looking at, if you can, is choose a time, sit down, have a strong motivation, what you want to achieve. It may be you've decided to do two short sessions or three short sessions or two longer sessions, but decide what you're going to do with the morning. when you sit down, really make a strong positive motivation for your practice that morning. Imbue it with the Mahayana bodhicitta. Then my advice would be to start with a meditation on compassion. Opening the heart. After you've done that meditation, and try to make it for 24 minutes if you can, then maybe take a break. And in that break, perhaps read half a chapter of Lama Alice's book or a whole chapter, but keep your mind on shamatha. Okay? When you've read and thought about that, take another break and then maybe do another meditation. And this time, a meditation that includes relaxation, stability, vividness. As if your meditation object was the breath. Make it a 24-minute session. Imbue all of that with as deep a relaxation as you can, with stillness and with vigilance. If you haven't tried the supine position, give that a go. Give that a go. Yeah. And we're not making it heavy, just make it gentle, make it short set. All sessions that you do, it's much better that you finish feeling you could have done more. And then you're happy to go back. So that would be my suggestion for the morning. But if you're already used to doing your own practice, because many of you will have a daily practice, then you do your daily practice, perhaps do some of the meditations on shamatha, maybe take the opportunity, if you can, to read some of Lama Alan's book, very excellent. I suppose the idea is to try and keep your mind on shamatha, not so much going off to anything else, if you can. If you can. Okay. Any questions about that? Personal practice is the way forward, really. It's the way forward. Okay. Well, thank you for that. So today has been interesting, busy. I think we've covered a lot. Everything we've talked about in this weekend, it's the baseline for the other two objects of mind and its contents and awareness. All of that rests on what we've done this weekend. This is the bedrock, what we've done this weekend. All we're really going to do from now on is kind of shift the object. Okay? So please just consider the motivation that you had right at the very beginning. Just try to reflect your mind back on that. What was your motivation? What was it you wanted to achieve? Between then and now, we've all created so much positive merit. Easy to lose. So we want to direct that towards achieving what we set out to achieve. Keep it safe. Keep it safe, we'll reap the rewards of it. And so by remembering and focusing and directing this energy that you've towards achieving that, you can stay there. It's very nice. But prayers are very helpful, extremely helpful. And so if you're happy to do so, we can do the prayers. Lama Sangi Drukyuni Drowa Chinkyang Maluka Yeki Sala Janjo sen cho rin ho shi ma ki pa dam ki vyu chi ki pa nyam pa me pa yam May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, that has not arisen, arise and grow. May that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. For as long as space endures, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Thank you. So, good luck for tomorrow morning. Gently. Short sessions. Have a nice lunch and I'll see you at 2 o'clock. Thank you for today.
Thank you very much.